Everybody. I am Anne Applebaum. I'm a professor of practice at the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics. I am chairing a panel today with actually a very unusually talented and interesting group of people. The panel is associated with and somehow in honor of the display of New York Times photography, which you will find elsewhere in the school, and there are a series of events that have been organized around that, But we've actually used this occasion to bring together several people who have real expertise on the subject of what we used to call fake news, but since that doesn't work anymore, and then we started calling it disinformation, and we're actually going to talk about why maybe that doesn't work anymore. But in any case, the new ways in which reality is distorted by media and social media, and what is the relationship and what are the lessons for democracy. The panel consists of my colleague Peter Pomerantsev, who together with me runs a program called ARENA, which both analyzes the causes of, analyzes this new phenomenon and also experimentally looks at solutions. We work in conjunction with other groups and organizations and do studies of particular incidents and look for and are testing different answers. We're lucky to have Oliver Bullock on the panel, who is the author of a very prominent British journalist and the author of Moneyland, which is a spectacularly good book on money laundering, corruption, tax havens, and why they're and what's wrong with them and why they're undermining our democracies, and we think that's relevant to this subject too. We also have Damian Tambini, who is a professor in the Media and Communications Department of the LSE, is the author of Digital Dominance. Sorry, I couldn't read my own handwriting. Of Digital Dominance, the Power of Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, and works a lot on also looking at the answers to some of these questions. And last but not least, I save for the last Max Fisher, who is a New York Times reporter and columnist, who's our connection to the New York Times exhibit, and who has, among other things, recently been in Silicon Valley talking about some of these issues. We have about an hour and a half. I will start by eliciting a conversation from my fellow panelists, and we'll talk among ourselves, and then we are happy to open it up and ask questions from the audience if there are any. I'm going to start with Peter, because I'd like him to talk a little bit about what I began with, which is namely this question of what it is. What do we mean by disinformation? Is it something that's new? Peter, I should say, is the author of a book on the Russian propaganda state with the fantastic title of Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And his experience writing that gave him a kind of head start on some of these issues, because much of what was first tried with and experimented with in the United States, we now see in lots of countries all over the world. Do we have any better sense now of what it is that we're talking about? You and I have been working on this problem now for a couple of years. What is it? How do we define it? And is it a particular problem for democracy, or are we talking about something else?
Yeah, I mean, it's there are whole fights in academia about how you define it. There are academics who won't speak to each other anymore if you use the term fake news. I've been at sort of events on the East Coast in the US where like people storm out. So there is now a taxonomy in place, which people at Harvard, Claire Wardle at Harvard, kind of developed, which is a really useful one in terms of giving us definitions. So she's classed it as misinformation, which is, people communicating inaccurate information accidentally or organically. There's disinformation, which is when it's done on purpose. And there's a third bit that I've forgotten. Anyway, so that's one way of looking at it. Then there's a lovely guy called Martin Innes at Cardiff University who prefers to talk about soft facts. So we have hard facts and soft facts. Soft facts, he includes rumors, conspiracy, all that kind of space. So listen, this sort of like finding a taxonomy in a language is really important, especially when you're talking about language. However, where we are, which is really at the coal face of looking at these campaigns, a lot of what we do is just literally sitting on the dankest bits of the internet together with computer scientists and investigative journalists and really seeing how these campaigns work. We've done that in several European countries, including Britain, which is a soon not to be European country. And really, this taxonomy is utterly useless. Because when it gets into the real campaigns, the real action of it, it's got nothing. It can be facts, it can be non-facts, it can be made up. That is so tertiary to what's going on. What we're talking about are forms of influence campaigns. And as a society, we have to decide what sort of influence campaigns are normal and abnormal. We don't have any kind of common understanding on what that is, and maybe Damon can talk about that. We have people maybe not understanding they're being targeted in ways. And really, you know, look, we spent a long time looking at the far right and Russian campaigns in Germany. It's flaring up again now in the wake of the riots in Chemnitz. And a lot of the time they will use real immigrant crime, but then present it in a way which will make you feel it's the number one theme in the country. So it can be a tendentious presentation of facts. So I'd rather think about the effects rather than what goes into them. And the effects, I do find there is sort of a pattern. And what we're seeing is a breakdown, I suppose, of maybe of a model of deliberative democracy that maybe never existed, but we at least once aspired to. So what we're seeing is a breakdown of shared reality. We're seeing a less and less constructive speech where people can talk about the political issues of the day. And we're seeing an increased, I'm going to use the word polarization, maybe it's not the best word, but a kind of like people disappearing into what looks like political ideologies but are actually political identities, and their political discourse is all around affirming their identity at the expense of other identities. And we often see campaigns based around that. The Brett Kavanaugh situation in the US is, I think, a very good example. So that's why it's a danger to democracy, and that's why it's especially dangerous for democracies.
Because it divides, it eliminates the space in which people can have a normal kind of political debate.
Well, I was in Washington last week, and it's just basically people screaming at each other, MSM, patriarchy, MSM! I mean, whatever it is, it's not democracy, the democracy we aspire to. Now, there was probably a lot of this always, but at least there were kind of oases where you could then get into, you know, a different kind of conversation. And maybe we're being nostalgic. Maybe, you know, that kind of like, you know, 18th century ideal of democracy never really existed and we should be more honest with ourselves. But I don't really see how the democracy we've known up till now will be able to sort of negotiate its way through this, you know, very new sort of digital media space.
And why is it new? What's different about it from, you know, political campaigns or smear campaigns in the past?
There's just a hell of a lot more of it, firstly. I mean, we can talk about it. I think a lot of things have changed. But I think what used to happen, for better or worse, was almost like a series of sublimations. So a person felt that they were represented by a newspaper or a politician, and they would then go and represent them in Parliament or on Newsnight, and they'd have a debate. Now, we can talk about the incredible limitations of that debate. It didn't include racism, maybe it didn't include some economic ideas, which should have been included. There's a lot of criticisms one can make of that, but it was at least a part to having some sort of conversation. You know, and first, everybody was very excited about sort of the idea that social media could bring in, you know, a flood of new arguments and voices. But there seems to be a tendency that instead of, you know, enhancing a strong deliberative debate, we just have a lot of people screaming at each other and not even trying to listen to each other. We could also get into the nature of social media, which seems to encourage group polarization rather than some sort of interface with other groups and other interests. But that's what we found. So really, rather than over-focusing on disinformation, misinformation, fake news, I think we really have to try to understand how do we build sort of a crucible for democracy in the 21st century. Maybe we shouldn't over-nostalgize what we had before. That could well be a false golden era. But the question is, what do we do going forward?
Mm-hmm. Oliver, I'm going to ask you to speak next, because you've done a lot of work in the last couple of years on corruption and the kind of endemic corruption that we haven't even necessarily always called corruption, because it's so much a part of our financial systems. Could you talk a little bit about how that is related to disinformation? Again, you're also somebody who has a background working in Russia, and since then you've worked, you know, you've followed these issues around the world. Do you see some kind of relationship between these two problems.
So, yeah, I mean, my book, which has just come out, which is called Moneyland, is essentially my attempt to explain how it's happened that all over the world, sort of simultaneously, the elites of most countries have managed to almost divorce themselves from their citizens. They have, you know, if you look at countries like Ukraine, which are a very dramatic example, the elite in Ukraine almost isn't Ukrainian anymore. Their children aren't there. They don't keep their assets in Ukraine. They settle their disputes in courts in London. You know, it is the country has almost been colonized by an elite from elsewhere. And that elite isn't anywhere in particular, which is why I call it where they live Moneyland. It's a place that doesn't exist. It's everywhere and nowhere. And basically, you buy access to it by employing gifted accountants, lawyers, people who can structure your assets in such a way that they don't exist anywhere. They are in the cloud or offshore, as we often refer to them. What's particularly interesting hearing when I talk to Peter and Anne about misinformation, disinformation, alternative facts, whatever we're calling it, is how there's a very strong correlation between countries that have been very badly affected by the Moneyland phenomenon and countries that have been very badly affected by the misinformation phenomenon. The elites of places that like to steal are very often the elites of places that like to lie. And the amount of stealing that goes on is really, you know, very dramatic. I think the sort of best estimates of the amount of money that is in Moneyland that's out there and not really anywhere in particular is sort of between 8 and 10% of all the money in the world. It's an absolute massive amount of money. And in the way I look at it, essentially, that the lying is intimately connected to the theft because... obviously, if you steal money, if you're very gifted at using sort of offshore structures and you're very good at hiding your property, you're good at burying it deep in the world economy where it's for world financial system where it's very hard to find. But there are two parts to this. Partly you want to make it very hard to find, and partly you want to stop people looking for it. And one of the good things about winding people up with misinformation is you make them think about something else. You see this very clearly in Russia. You know, the amount of money that's flown out of Russia in the last, you know, decade, two decades is pretty much uncountable. I mean, we saw just last month the Danske Bank Estonian branch scandal, which is what 200 billion euros flowed through the bank accounts of just one branch of just one bank. And, you know, and this is, you know, just a small fraction of the amount of money that's come out of Russia over that was over an 8-year period. And yet, if you look at the narrative that the Russians will tell you, that the narrative of the Russian government is all about other things completely. It's about, you know, the appeal simultaneously to Steve Bannon with this sort of appeal to kind of a right-wing narrative of national renewal, while also appealing to Seamus Milne with a sort of left-wing narrative of anti-imperialism. They will be all things to all people in order to stop anyone looking at what's actually happening. I thought the Russian narrative that followed the revolution in Ukraine was very telling. The revolution in Ukraine was above all an anti-corruption revolution, or certainly that was a very large component of it, a sort of anger with the mismanagement and misgovernment of the country. And yet the story the Russians told with great success was this was a fascist uprising against a legitimate president, essentially driven by a sort of strong sort of anti-Semitic tendency. It was they had this, yeah, simultaneously, mysteriously, a kind of international Jewry and anti-Semites somehow in a sort of collaboration against, you know, Mr. Putin. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but it doesn't need to make any sense. It's about winding people up, making people angry, shouting at each other rather than analysing what's really going on. I mean, we saw the same thing in South Africa with the Gupta scandal. You try and get these wedge issues, drive people to talk about identity rather than talking about money because it's sort of all about the money. Essentially, the way I analyse it is the misinformation is like a magician's patter. You know, when they're picking your pocket, they're doing something amazing with their right hand. They've got some kind of chat going on to make you think about what they're saying and not look at what they're doing. And so, I think that's why it comes so easily to the elites of countries that are very afflicted by kleptocratic tendencies is because they really, really don't want you to think about what they're actually doing. I see it essentially, I mean, misinformation is part of corruption. It's part of preventing any analysis of the true underlying phenomenon, which is, you know, so often theft.
Yeah, I've actually been very struck... you know, over the last few months by the number of the violence against, not just violence against journalists in general, but the violence against journalists who are investigating corruption. We've had one murder in Malta. We had a murder in Slovakia. There may have been a murder in Bulgaria. We don't know yet whether that's directly connected to what the journalist was doing or not. Is this because it is the process of finding out or of identifying or proving corruption that is now the thing that's most dangerous to political elites? Is that
I thought we saw this with the murder of Alexander Litvinenko in London, which is, you know, he had been working quite closely with the Spanish authorities to reveal the activities of the Russian mob, and, you know, which obviously is the Russian government in Spain and their assets. And, you know, so the correlation between when he was murdered and the information that he had passed over to the Spanish, it's very close. I mean, obviously we don't know exactly why he was killed, but it's certainly very indicative that that's what happened. And I think some of the rhetoric is, I mean, I think possibly the most fascinating example is Venezuela. Venezuela is engaged in this high-powered war of words with the United States, which is, you know, could almost not be more shrill. And yet, if you look at the real estate investment statistics from southern Florida, particularly to Miami-Dade County, you know, the single largest source of foreign investment into Miami-Dade County for the last, I mean, as long as anyone's been counting, it has been Venezuela. You can't get capital out of Venezuela without government approval. So this is government insiders are investing in the enemy. They are sending their money abroad, and yet simultaneously they are, with the other hand, screaming and shouting about how much they hate the Americans to stop anyone noticing that they're doing it. You see exactly the same thing with the Russians. The Russians, you know, Britain is the favourite enemy at the moment, and yet, you know, Britain remains inevitably the favoured destination for Russian investment in real estate. So it's startling how the misinformation runs counter to what's actually happening, and in fact it's happened so often that it's clearly deliberate.
Mm-hmm. Max, one of the projects that Peter and I have worked on is with an Italian newspaper, where we're doing a number of things looking at the way they report and what kinds of responses people have and so on. But one of the interesting things that we've noticed is that over the last couple of years, the paper's reporting has shifted quite a bit to focus much more exclusively on the subject of immigration, which was not the main issue in Italian politics in the past. The main issues were the economic crisis, the euro crisis, and to the extent that there were anti-European feelings, they were mostly focused on economic issues. The shift to describing and focusing on and discussing immigration, refugees, and issues around that seems to be deeply connected to the rise of the Liga, the political party in Italy that is particularly focused on this issue, and the skill with which its leader, Salvini, has successfully polarized Italians around this issue. You know, either you're for security, safety, and the fight against crime, and therefore you're against immigration, or you're in favor of crime, the end of Italy, and you're in favor of immigration. In other words, he's divided people over an issue that wasn't actually the primary issue in Italy, and maybe by some counts shouldn't be. It's not the reason why Italy's economy has gone wrong. It's not the explanation for all kinds of other things, and yet it's become this central issue. And this brings up the question of what is the role of mainstream journalism faced with that kind of disinformation campaign. I mean, the Italian campaign, the Salvini's campaign, is very much as Peter described. It's not exactly that Salvini is producing fake news. It's more that he has a narrative and uses some real facts, some exaggerated facts, every day, designed to get people to focus on this issue where he feels like, you know, where he's winning the argument and to make his... So how does a mainstream newspaper who needs to report on the leadership of the country, and, you know, the New York Times faces this problem every day with Trump. How do you think about that as a journalist?
I think one of the mistakes that we have made was thinking about it rather idealistically, just in terms of facts, without thinking as much as we should have about the underlying psychology of how people think about facts. We really wanted to believe that everybody was like us. Their top priority in the whole world was objective truth and facts, and that was like the number one thing they cared about. And if that fact contradicted their worldview, then like all the better to go out and learn about it. But it turns out that is actually not how people work at all, and we've been a little slow to understand that because it changes our role, it changes how we think about what our mission is. As a kind of case study of this, I think a lot about this town in Alabama called Albertville. Has anybody heard of this place? It was like ground zero for the anti-immigrant backlash in the United States maybe 2 or 3 years ago. A lot of the laws that the Trump administration uses targeting immigrants and undocumented immigrants are actually copies of laws that came out of there, where they had a big backlash against immigrants. And the story of the town as it was kind of initially understood is that like 10 years ago, a bunch of undocumented immigrants showed up, which is true, around the same time as labor unions collapsed, as a lot of low-wage jobs moved out of the city and the state because of globalization, and as a lot of methamphetamine came in, so there was a lot of crime. And the kind of the story that we had was that people were blaming immigrants wrongly, which, you know, they were wrong to blame immigrants for this, but were incorrectly blaming immigrants for that, and that was the source of the backlash. And if you could kind of come in and just show people, no, these things are not actually connected, then they would say, oh, okay, well, I guess we don't need to have these unnecessarily harsh immigration policies because immigrants are not actually driving the methamphetamine crisis and are not to blame for the rise of labor unions. But what I think people, and I'm not just thinking about journalists here, but anyone who was kind of involved working around Albertville at the time or immigrant issues now, didn't quite grasp is that the factual connection between those things was secondary. What people were feeling in Albertville was not a kind of analytical sense of like, let me try to determine the cause of me losing my job and safety and then address that in the most thoughtful, nuanced way possible. It was a sense of what psychologists call group identity threat. They felt that they as a community were under threat. They didn't like that. And the most visible form of that threat was cultural change that they felt they had not opted into in the form of a lot of Spanish-speaking people showing up to their town. So that was the form that they target against. And when politicians came in and said, undocumented immigrants are the reason for all of these problems. And that's what we would call misinformation, because that was not factually true, but that was not actually the cause of the anti-immigrant backlash. And newspapers running a bunch of stories saying, no, no, Jeff Sessions, who was a big part of this, is lying when he says that undocumented immigrants are the reason you're losing your jobs. That wasn't actually going to change anybody's thinking or behavior in this because it was not actually driving it. And I think we're kind of just now getting to a point where we're starting to much better understand how people interact with and especially how they seek out information that will validate their sense of group identity and kind of how they want to see the world and what the role is of an organization that is trying to help people arrive at a more factual understanding of the world.
And what's the conclusion then for journalists? Should you behave differently? Should is it wrong to report the facts? I mean, should you be campaigning for something else? What's the answer?
I think the answer is first and foremost, if you're reporting on a place like Albertville, or like if you're in Brazil now and you're trying to understand why are people supporting this guy Bolsonaro, it's not enough to just accept the surface explanations for why people want or say they want, or maybe even believe they want the things they want. And you have to have a much deeper understanding of, okay, people in Brazil are really upset and seeking out a strong-fisted leader because corruption over the last few years has given them a sense that, you know, the world is falling down around them, which is not totally wrong, and a desire for someone to assert control. And you have to filter that into how you report about where the support is coming from and what Bolsonaro is actually promising and can actually deliver.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a newspaper's responsibility to kind of heal the situation. So in Albertville, the New York Times shouldn't be seeking to bring together, if you have a polarized town, to bring together different people. That's not the function of the newspaper.
I mean, I think that even if we decided it was our function, as soon as you do that, it de facto becomes a position on a contentious issue, right? Even if you're saying we're just trying to bring together dialogue between polarized disparate groups, people kind of know where you're going with that and tend to have a backlash against it. And we're such an environment right now where just identifying yourself as truth-based media identifies you to many people as the enemy.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to you and ask you about Silicon Valley in a second, but first I wanted to ask Damien. Among other things, Damien, you're an expert on kind of you know, put my cards on the table. I think that the solutions to this problem are varied and multiple, and there will be several different kinds of solutions, and they'll work differently in different countries. But you're an expert on this question: what can governments do, or what are regulatory answers? Could you talk a little bit about what work you've done in that area and how it's very tricky. You know, we all live in societies where we are against censorship. We don't want the government to run the media or to decide what's true and what's mm-hmm. not. But are there ways that we can regulate the playing field to make it easier for people or more to make people more inclined to choose true explanations for events rather than fictitious ones?
Okay, so we're in a university, so I'm going to ask us to take a few steps back.
Okay.
And think about this in terms of long-term historical changes and the media system and how it works. So if we start with John Milton writing the Areopagitica.
Yeah, that's going back a long way.
Going back a very long way. But he said, and this is, everyone quotes this, right? Let truth and falsehood grapple. Never was truth put to the worse in a fair and open encounter. Okay. So that idea, this notion that in the free marketplace of ideas, in the contestation between truth and falsehood, somehow, miraculously, truth will emerge. First thing to remember, that is not how we designed our media systems. We did not let truth and falsehood grapple in a fair encounter. We tried to rig the media system in favor of truth. So over the centuries since Milton, what emerged was a set of settlements around freedom of the press, around the way broadcasting is licensed, and above all, around the notion of journalism. Journalism as a filter of the truth. Okay, if you came from a radical perspective, you saw this as a kind of ideological conspiracy. Within the liberal democratic tradition, we saw this media system as something which tipped the balance in favor of truth. And I think we have to understand that what is happening in terms of system change in the media is that the way people get their information is bypassing this set of very complex socio-legal filters and institutions and practices of journalism. And it's come to a head in the recent elections. We could see a kind of a perfect storm. So the things that people have mentioned, the group polarization effects that come with the fact that humans do not seek truth. They seek and share opinion and all sorts of nonsense on the basis of their own views and their own biases. What has also happened is that we've had polarization, and we've had the fruit of very long philosophical developments, the opposition of liberalism and communitarianism and relativism, just to mention the most important. So I think as a result of some coming together of these long-term processes in the context of bypassing the truth filter of the media system, we have a real problem, and we've seen it in what I would describe as a real crisis of the legitimacy of democratic processes. There seem to be all sorts of ways of foreign interference. There seems to be a lot of difficulty of maintaining a level playing field in elections. And there seem to be ways in which existing electoral laws, for example, on spending, have been bypassed. There is, if you like, a real assault, a war on democracy as a result of this coming together of very different processes. So policy is responding, and I think we're in this kind of race against time. Almost every day, and I'm following these very closely, a new policy report is coming out. There is a worry that the pendulum will swing too far in the opposite direction. You have problems from the point of view of freedom of expression, of new laws in Germany, for example. But most of the activity, if I just divide them into kind of short-term, narrow policy interventions that are going on, most of the activity is really in terms of self-regulation by particularly the platforms, codes of conduct, the European Union, flags and tags. So Facebook flagging and tagging and cooperating with fact-checkers, for example, to be more transparent, and promotion of media literacy. Tweaking electoral law to make the spending limits work better. But I think what the big challenge is going to be over the next 5 to 10 years is whether, in a sense, we can replicate those truth filters in a radically changed environment. And that comes down, I think, to, in a very concentrated market of social media, the responsibility of those very large platforms. Zuckerberg has accepted that it's not if, it's how and when it comes to regulation of Facebook. We will see government announcements in the coming weeks and months, and we will see, I think, a big, big shift in terms of how social media are themselves regulated. People say you can't regulate social media because they're global and they move around too much. Nonsense. Not that I suggest we follow the example of Russia and China, but they have demonstrated that it's possible to regulate social media. Social media can be taxed more. They can be subject to new kinds of competition law. There are all sorts of things that can be done. And the next months and years are going to be a negotiation with the platforms about how they actually deliver on their responsibilities whilst at the same time protecting fundamental rights like freedom of expression.
Before I follow up, so actually Peter and I have both also been to Silicon Valley and talked to Facebook, but I know that you have also, Max.
It's a weird place.
Yes. What are the real prospects for, you know, lots of people have, I mean, certainly we have all talked about the need for, you know, could we create a broad social coalition, including, I don't know, NGOs and the government and platforms working together to solve this problem jointly? Are there ways to regulate the platform? And what was your recent impression of, you know, how willing the platforms are to be regulated and to think seriously about this?
I think on some level they kind of crave regulation. They would never say this publicly, but they've gotten to a point where they're now in charge of not all human speech, but a pretty good amount of human speech for 2.5 billion people in every language in every country around the world. And they're at a point now where they're big enough that they are seen as responsible for it, but they have, and I don't think they would consider this unfair, really no idea what they're doing. I mean, no sense for how to control for what is socially dangerous speech, no sense for how to identify what's true, not true, where is it appropriate for them to draw these lines. And they don't want to be in charge of these things, in charge of deciding what's acceptable political speech and not acceptable political speech. When is a rumor in Myanmar at a risk of inciting an act of ethnic cleansing, and when is it just free speech? They just want to run, you know, Facebook groups and send you birthday reminders and make a lot of money. But now that they're in charge of all human discourse and speech, you know, they're really not that up to it. They don't have that many people tasked for it. I think for all of Myanmar, they have like 70 people patrolling all of the content in this country where they know it's actively involved in inciting genocide. I mean, people talk about Germany as an example of aggressive social media regulation, which has always seemed crazy to me. The law in Germany is that Facebook has to review and, if they deem it breaks the law, remove any post flagged by any user within, I think it's 24 hours, 24 or 48. And everybody talks about this like, this is so great, Germany is getting so tough on Facebook, but what they've done is essentially outsourced their court system to a private company based in Silicon Valley in California that has not that many lawyers on staff. So, I mean, I think we're kind of, I don't know, the thing that sometimes gets me about the discussion about regulating or not regulating social media is that we're starting with the premise that it's appropriate and good and a fact of life that these giant private companies in California are in charge of making decisions about acceptable versus unacceptable speech and political discourse. And I don't think that we should be accepting that.
Damien, is there a better model anybody's coming up with in Britain? I mean, I have had conversations here with intelligent MPs who think that, you know, they're step by step. We can, you know, we could, for example, make public debate about how the algorithms work. You know, could we make that part? Could there be an algorithm commission that's part of Parliament that looks at what's being favored and not being favored? Have you heard of anything that could work or anything that you think could be useful?
Well, there's an American legal scholar, Frank Pasquale, who's been arguing for many years now that whilst there are privacy and commercial confidentiality reasons why you can't open up the algorithm and potentially also personal data, what you can do is have a system whereby a regulatory authority has powers to ask for certain kinds of data, certain kinds of information, in order to pursue its regulatory ends. And I think that's where the current system clearly isn't working, because we're actually getting more blind about these kinds of processes than we were with MSM or, you know, legacy media in terms of the data that we have and what we understand. But, I mean, this question of the liability arrangements comes down to a very techie debate about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and in the US and in Europe, Schedule 14 of the e-commerce directive. And what they do, more or less in the same way, is say, until an ISP or a platform or a content host is notified that it is hosting illegal content, it has no responsibility to remove it. And it says a number of other things, like governments cannot impose an obligation on those platforms. But when they're told about illegal content, they have a duty to take it down. What the German law does is reflect a debate that they've been very slack and slow about taking hate speech, illegal hate speech in particular, down, and incitement and all sorts of nasty stuff down, and terrorism-related speech, under those duties. So the German law tightens this up. What it doesn't do is get into the other area. There's a fuzzy area, which is what I think you described as socially difficult speech or stuff we don't like.
What Peter was describing, you know, those malign influence campaigns, which aren't technically lying.
So if it's not illegal, and lying is not illegal, but it is nonetheless maybe would be, for example, against the rules that historically we've had for broadcasters around impartiality or responsible journalism or some other kind of standard. Historically, what we've done is said, okay, that's a matter for journalism, for ethics, for self-regulation, autonomy from the state. What's very important in the settlement that comes out of this is that we maintain that somehow. So we need to hold, I hate this metaphor, but it's because it's about torture, but we do need to hold Facebook's feet to the fire. So my suggestion would be that in the next period, there does need to be some sort of an institution, a new regulatory authority, or a new kind of observatory, which has power to request data, which has a clear duty to articulate what are our expectations and needs as citizens of these platforms in terms of their responsibilities, and can then inform a debate about whether those liability arrangements need to be changed, whether the competition framework needs to be changed, and whether they need to be taxed a little bit more like tobacco and alcohol, and a little bit less like newspapers, because newspapers still get tax breaks. Okay, so are they gonna
are they a dangerous
go down,
substance?
Are they gonna behave
yeah.
themselves?
Right.
But they, you know, the question of how they behave themselves is for them in dialogue with civil society. If you have governments setting the rules, that's the problem for free speech, and that's the problem. Think about the newspapers, the difficulty we've had for the last century. If you get governments getting too close to newspapers, making shadowy deals, trading policy favours, that's when you have a whole other set of difficulties for democracy. I don't want intransparent shadowy deals between social media companies and governments anywhere in the world, least of all here.
Mm-hmm. Peter, I know you've been working on some projects that look at kind of not so much regulation but counter messaging. So if there is a if Salvini in Italy or I don't know, Duterte in the Philippines is running a malign influence campaign designed to divide people, is there a way that, I don't know, if it's NGOs, is it journalists, is there, you know, are there ways to counter that that don't involve government regulation?
I mean, yes. I mean, in terms of solutions, it's a little bit of is regulatory. But at the end of the day, most of the time, we're just going to have to compete in this new information environment. And it's a real question for me, because so let's say we have Albertville, this horribly polarized town, or Washington, D.C., this horribly polarized town, and it's not the newspaper's role, or the newspapers can't be the force that helps sort of, create or recreate some sort of space for common understanding, then whose job is that? I mean, in Britain we have the BBC, which is a unique institution, which has a person in charge of impartiality and somebody who thinks about audiences all day. But I think it's pretty much the only media institution in the world that does that, and it's quite a strange one. I understand it's not the New York Times' job to be the depolarizing force, but who's going to do that then? So I think what we're going to start seeing is a new kind of civil society actor. It might well be the way civil society has to reinvent itself for the 21st century, whose job is to do that. Which is going to be, look, we didn't have human rights NGOs until, a certain point in history. So civil society does recreate itself for the needs of the day. So I think we're starting to see some green shoots happen around that, very, very kind of tiny ones, largely in the kind of like the counter-radicalization space, as it's called. So little NGOs trying to reach out to people who are being radicalized by far-right groups and trying to sort of build a discourse which is less othering. But this has to be done at scale. This has to be done with huge technological power for it to really work. But I think somebody's going to have to do this, and I'm not quite sure who it is. There's no one at the moment whose job it is.
You will do it here.
Well, that's what we're experimenting in. We're the laboratory, but we kind of need a, we kind of need a party and a march through the institutions.
But what is it? I mean, what is the thing that...
It's groups who get up in the morning and whose job is to bring people together in Albertville. So there have been some experiments. Again, in America, there's a project in Chicago where a newspaper has tried to heal the divide in Michigan. Let's get different people together and get them talking again. There are little experiments happening in America, but yes, they don't fit into classical media. Their job isn't to inform necessarily. You might not even want facts driving the conversation. In the various trials we've run, we find that when you try a data-driven approach, it divides people massively. So people who agree with the data will say, look, the facts prove that all immigrants rape pigs or whatever. And the people who disagree with it says, where'd you get this data from, mate? No. So the last thing you do is a data-driven approach if you want to build any kind of, foster any kind of dialogue. We're finding that constructive news might be a way forward. So getting people to think about the solution. So generating a discourse where factual information can become useful going forward. But I completely understand that's not the job of the New York Times. It might be slightly more the job of the BBC, but generally, I think it's going to be a new kind of actor who emerges, who thinks about this all the time.
I mean, Oliver, are there people in the world of people thinking about and fighting corruption who might be that kind of actor?
I don't know. I mean, it's a bit of a, if all you've got is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. I mean, the thing about the weapon in anti-corruption is transparency. You have to know who owns what. And once you know who owns what, at least you'll be able to see who's stolen what.
But what if people don't believe it? I mean, you print information and everybody says, that's just,
But you would hope that if there is a sort of a government registry of who owns what, and it's verified and it's verifiable and it's open, then and you can see who's paying for things and who is, where the information comes from and who's providing it, then at least you allow people to see where the information comes from. There's a great line in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, which I sort of have as a, it's sort of slightly tattooed on the inside of my eyelids, which is when Arthur Weasley, who might be my favourite character in the entire Harry Potter canon, if not literature, has a real go at his daughter for having been bewitched by the diary that's possessed by the spirit of Lord Voldemort. And he says, "How many times do I have to tell you, Ginny, never trust anything that can think for itself if you can't see where it keeps its brain?" And that, I think, is a really good message for everything about this sort of dark money, dark data-driven environment. If you can't see where something keeps its brain, then you shouldn't trust it.
But just the counter-argument. So in Brazil, okay, I'm not a huge expert in Brazil, but I've seen it in other countries, and it seems to be what's happening in Brazil when I read kind of like New York Times, like 500-word pieces on it. So there you had exposure of corruption, and then the sense of helplessness that we can't do anything about it. And then, you know, the only way to do something about it is a, what did you call him, a strong-fisting man? A strong-fisted man, because he's going to kind of come in and sort it out. And, sorry, that, but, a horrible image, sorry. In Russian, it's just strong hand. No, but that, and I've heard people from Transparency International, and Tom King has spoken about this a lot, about this actually, there's nothing worse than knowing. In Russia, we know, we see, and nothing can be done about it. And that then gives this feeling of helplessness. So again, I think, so is it two steps when you think about transparency and then the mechanisms which would bring around change? So
yeah, just to underline that point, I mean, there is always the risk that the exposure of corruption not only makes people say, right, we want to chuck this person out of power, it also makes them say, well, look, the whole system is rotten. We don't believe in anything.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the dream is you nip it in the bud before it gets to the point when the whole system is infected. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's you know, a transparency and enforcement of sensible regulations. You know, I mean, we have a situation in Britain at the moment where what, you know, according to the National Crime Agency, £190 billion is laundered through the City of London every year, and the NCA's Economic Crime Directorate has a budget of £10 million. You know, we're fighting a tank with a, you know, balsa wood sword. It, you know, we are a long way away from being able to deal with the problem that, the way we need to be dealing with it. But it's, yeah, I mean, but transparency helps with enforcement because it means that there's less to find out. It's easier to find the information you need. So I don't know. I mean, I think those are the two weapons against corruption, and actually it seems like those would be the two weapons against misinformation as well. If you have, you know, sensible regulations and it's, you can be transparency about who's breaking them, then you end up in as good a place as you can be to defend liberal democracy.
But what about, I mean, Damien has made the point that it's not clear that people always want to know the truth, and that actually we've set up a system that has made it easier to get, but...
This is a sort of Jack Nicholson,
right?
You know, you can't handle the truth argument. I don't know. I think people can handle the truth. I think people tend to be able to. You know, it's. I mean, I think there are very few facts that are so grisly that people can't handle them. I think that it's better to treat people as adults and not patronise them in you know, in the Jack Nicholsonian manner. Though he did do it very well.
I mean, in public policy debates, you know, if you're trying to solve a problem. And I'm just thinking about, say, we had a debate, and I've had numerous debates over the years about media plurality and ownership. But where you always get, and it very often happens in public policy, is, well, we can't do anything, so we'll have some transparency, we'll inform consumers better, and they will kind of solve the problem, but just give more information to people. So public information campaigns, transparency. I agree it's part of the solution, as regards corruption in general. But I think there are additional things we need. You know, civil society needs to have the capacity to respond. And part of that is an adequately funded, well-resourced, robust, independent media. And I think even in a situation, I mean, you know, I was trying to think while you were speaking about your really fascinating sounding research. You know, it's also about a situation in which if the link to disinformation is that it's a smokescreen, you know, these kinds of things are happening all around the planet. There are all sorts of real injustices and corruption that is happening, and part of the smokescreen is all of this disinformation. How do you ensure that media systems in the future tip the balance in favour of being able to investigate that, and actually being able for societies to have a deliberative process, have a discussion among themselves about drawing a line? And I think We need to think a little bit more about how to make those media systems work, and that's a holistic thing. I think there are a number of other kind of horizon issues that we can't begin to touch around what propaganda might be and about how you might need to regulate them. Part of it might be about making Facebook more transparent and open and making it more liable for different kinds of categories of content. But a situation in which you can create an information environment around an individual person and really take away their autonomy in decision-making, whether that's to vote or their view of reality. That seems to me to raise completely new issues around regulation. We need a kind of a new theory of propaganda there.
No, I'm wondering how to connect these two issues. So I find a lot of the conversations around disinformation, corruption, they interface in so many interesting ways. But, okay, let's say we find in Alberta... Okay, now this is a very Albertville.
Albertville,
yeah. Alphaville.
Alberta's something different.
I'm aware of that. So we go back to Alphaville, and you discover a story there about actually it was like a corruption issue that was actually, you know, driving their economic crisis. So Oliver discovers that, and we find all the money laundering shell companies that spirited money away from Alphaville. And then, I mean... As a newspaper, I mean, isn't the way forward then not just to expose it, but then to do a whole campaign around it, and then to build up trust of the local population, to show that you really are being the fourth estate, and you really are being their kind of, taking up their cause vis-a-vis the powerful. But that would mean you leaving any kind of neutrality position and becoming much more activist-y. I just wonder whether that's a future for newspapers. Actually, just look, if there's no objectivity anymore, if no one cares about facts, what shouldn't we just dive into being much more activist-y and generate trust and a sense of, you know, democratic change by actually being very partisan?
I think part of the challenge with when you have collapse in trust in institutions, it tends to be across the board, right? People don't just single out, you know, corrupt elites, or they don't just single out newspapers that are reporting facts that I object to or dislike, or they don't just single out, you know, the Supreme Court because they have objections, maybe reasonable, maybe not, about how the justices are selected. It tends to be across the board, right? And that's what we see in places like Brazil, the Philippines, the United States, where people decide as a whole the institutions need to be thrown at. And I think what's tricky about that is that when you say, okay, well, let's find one institution that's working well and have it function in a totally different way to try to make up for the other institutions that are not working, it tends to backfire a little bit. I think that when you're dealing with a problem as big as, and I feel like generally with things like corruption and disinformation, we're kind of coming around to the idea that it's not just that thing, it's the complete collapse in trust in institutions and all of the causes that has. That it can't just be newspapers are going to fix it by printing, you know, more nuanced or more truthful stories. I think we should. I think that's a good thing for us to do. And I think, you know, the reason I know about what happened in Albertville was because of some really good journalism there where they, like, you know, you could argue what they did was bring people together. They got to deeper truths. It was really thoughtful. But that didn't make people decide that they trust institutions and therefore were willing to accept the presence of people who look like them. It had to be much more comprehensive political change.
On that note, I would be delighted to take questions or brief comments from the audience. How are we doing this? Are there microphones or are people just going to shout? Oh, no, Kara has a microphone. So we'll start over there since you're next to the microphone. And if you could introduce yourself, that'd be great.
Hello. Vladislav Davidson. I'm an American journalist and editor. I live between France and Ukraine. And I work on some of these issues. And I guess my question, comment, is that as a journalist, as an American journalist who lives in Europe and watches what's going on from abroad, and I guess this is directed to Mr. Fisher, why not to your institution, the economic model of our profession has been destroyed by Facebook. So as Facebook and Google eat up 90% or more of all the ads in America, and I think in the world, although I don't know the exact statistics of the world, much of the what used to be the mainstream news in America has now, in some capacity or other, turned to partisan warfare. So in some ways, the New York Times, which my conservative friends would say has turned somewhat to fighting the resistance or being quote-unquote hashtag resistance, is part of the problem, right? From the way stories are structured on the front page to the back of the op-ed pages, our institution, journalism, has failed. And it's failed to keep up with the times, partly because of economic changes, which we've not been able to do anything about. I mean, the New York Times is the only American newspaper that has its own center of gravity. Everything else is in radical decline or is already dead or will be dead soon enough.
Might be one or two other papers left.
I was gonna say,
no, I wouldn't. Actually, I wouldn't say that's true. I would say the New York Times is the only American institution with its own center of gravity and economic model. I don't think anything else has a future. What would you say
to
that?
Washington Post makes money too, I have to tell you.
Sorry?
Washington Post makes money.
That's true.
Washington Post is
based.
Anyway.
Outlets are doing quite well.
Okay.
So I think I understand what your question is, and we'll try to answer it. So I think there's two things here. One is the media's business model too reliant on social media, and the other is social media distorting media coverage. Is that basically? Okay, I'll do the first two. How about that? And then someone else can ask a question. So subscription-based outlets are not that reliant on social media anymore because the readers come from, or a lot of money now comes from subscribers who really buy into the mission, which is great. So we don't need the Facebook clicks as much, which is true of us, The Post, a lot of other outlets. I don't want to, say it's across the board great news for media, but it's doing a lot better than it was a few years ago. In terms of does social media distort coverage, yes, but not from us. Like I said, we don't get that much traffic overall from social media the way that we used to, so whatever is happening on social media, by definition, cannot be distorting our coverage. But if you look at the top Facebook posts on any given day, which a service called CrowdTangle puts out every day, all the top performing Facebook posts in any country on any topic, in the United States at least, it's always from hyper-partisan non-news outlets. It's from Ben Shapiro's page, it's from random conservative hardline pro-Republican pages that you've never even heard of but are super popular on Facebook. And there's something inherent to the algorithms of the way these sites work that pushes up that stuff because that's more appealing to us psychologically, all of us, not just people who are, belong to a different party, have a different view. To have that affirmed group identity than to have a set of facts. So that is a challenge that comes from, I think it's easy to blame the social media companies, but comes from within human psychology to a great degree. But there are at least a lot of people still out there who just want to read the newspaper and are paying for it. So that's something.
That's interesting. Who pays for let me get a show of hands, who pays to subscribe to the media organization? It's about half.
And I'd be interested to know, and do the people who don't pay assume that they will always be able to get everything for free? That's because
I suppose we all kind of pay for the BBC in Britain, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I forgot to do my license fee.
Right, right.
They're coming round.
Okay, let's take two other quick questions. Right, so one there, you had your hand up first, and then one in the front row. So if you can be brief, and maybe I'll take a couple at once.
Just a question to Mr. Polo. It's because, well, there is Medusa and Rain in Russia. So do you consider them as a sources that give disinformation also to people? Because they consider themselves as a free media that actually speaks up for the population and they actually try to tell the truth. And this is this is the first question, if you think that they are free media sources. And then the second question is that I analyzed BBC and Russian media, the broadcaster Russia 2, and don't you think that they're actually trying to tell the truth, but they're trying to tell the truth with the Russian values in their mind? So, like, when they were talking about Ukrainian crisis, channel Russia 2 was telling some facts much deeper, which were more important for Russian population, and the BBC was actually telling just the like overview of the actual situation was happening, what was happening in Ukraine. They were not going very deeply into the like the problem of the population, the problem of the reason for the revolution. And the Russian media was actually trying to tell the truth them, but from the Russian view.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, we have experts on this panel who can answer that. Okay. Let's have one other question. Anybody? Right there. Yeah. But please be brief.
My name's Julian. I'm just a person off the street. It's more of an observation.
A person off the street? We're all people off the street.
I had this feed Zen from Yandex, the Russian Google, on my phone. And I noticed a real pattern. It's constantly putting stories what you could describe as Muslims behaving badly, and then sometimes reactions of local people in Sweden and Germany to Muslims behaving badly. And I've checked a lot of those stories. They are true. So I would say that basically what RT is putting out is actually both legal and truthful, but is nonetheless poisonous. It is appealing to a certain element of society. And if you try to stop that, I'm not sure how you would, because they could easily pump out, you say, oh, you're concentrating that. Well, they could pump out non-bland stories that no one would ever look at and still get the one story that they want you to see and give their message. And I don't know how you're going to fight that.
I feel that those two questions are related and that Peter should answer them.
I agree.
All right, thanks.
they were both about Russian media, so if you didn't hear that first.
I mean, so Russian state media, especially RTR, does not emerge from historically from a tradition which sees the role of journalism as being a conduit of facts, of truth, or of the fourth estate. It's perfectly normal within the Soviet tradition to see media as an extension of state power. Journalists see themselves as doing the Kremlin's bidding, whether the truth or not the truth. So even framing what they do inside a journalistic paradigm would not be understanding the Russian point of view. They would not frame it themselves that way. So I don't see how we can even approach that question conceptually. In terms of, yes, that's exactly it. And not even RT in Germany. We've looked at really much, much more visceral AfD campaigns in Germany, and most of it is they're taking real immigrant crime and then just saying this is the most important issue. So it's not going to be about facts. It's going to be about how do we reach these audiences who are affected by this? What drives these audiences? Fascinating studies by our new fellow at ARENA, Sophia Gaston, into why nostalgia is so popular among young people in Europe. So actually it's going to be a competition to understanding audiences better. Maybe that's going to be the future. But trying to battle it on the level of this Miltonian battle of truth versus fiction, that might, you know, I don't know if that's, there's a lot to do in a regulatory way, but for media, maybe we just have to think about audiences much, much more deeply and understand the needs for those narratives much, much more deeply. And then we can start engaging with them. But again, that would take, that's a long, painful, intellectually driven process when it's much easier to go, oh yeah, look, Muslims behaving badly. So we found a lot of publications in Germany who were just doing Muslims behaving badly for money. They don't care about politics. They're like, oh, this is working, let's feed them. So it's economically, you know, profitable to do partisan, radicalizing kind of news.
I'm sorry, Damien wanted to say something about this too.
You know, this is really difficult. You know, you could say, well, you know, you don't have to have that particular app on your phone. It's, you know, you have a responsibility, and maybe you're in a minority receiving this. If we view this through the frame of information war, okay, deliberate, sustained attempts to interfere in democratic processes, undermine trust, undermine legitimacy, create confusion. We have to also then consider that freedom of expression has a number of justified restrictions. So Article 10.2 of the European Convention says you can restrict freedom of expression, for example, to protect national security. Now, if we go a few more steps down that route, and not that far, in fact, given, I think, that the information that we have in the public domain about the kinds of things which have happened, particularly in the US and this country, then all sorts of controls become justifiable, even within the European Convention system. Because the information war is fundamentally asymmetrical. It's asymmetrical because in part of the world you have real protection of freedom of expression. And what that does from a strategic point of view is limit the ability of North America and Europe to respond in the information war, for example, by blocking, by creating licensing requirements on social media, and controlling that kind of those kinds of information forms. So in the current moment, you're absolutely right, it's not possible to regulate that. But if we actually begin to see in a few years' time that this information war continues, and we don't develop the self-regulatory and the media literacy tools to protect ourselves, then I think we'll see regulation. We'll become more like China, more like Russia in the process.
Right. Okay, let's take one there and one there, if we can do both of them. And then we'll do one in the back, and then that's then just for a few more.
Hi, I'm a visiting scholar at University of Westminster here. I come from Istanbul. I'm an academic there. Just wanted to ask Peter and Damien, you talked about an observatory or an authority to maybe monitor the speech on media, and Peter talked about a civil society needing new actors. And at this point, I'd like to hear what you think about the fact-checkers and fact-checking initiatives, which are particularly interesting cases in Turkey, where I'm coming from. And I wonder what you think of them. Can they be a new actor in civil society, or can they fill in the shoes or, you know, the role of this observatory, or how far can we trust them? Thank you.
Right, so it's a good question about fact-checkers. And then one more over here. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Lily, and I'm an MSc student here at the LSE. My question is, how do researchers and academics make a meaningful intervention in this crisis of disinformation when distrust of experts and the academy is also on the rise?
Right. Big question. So that's two. I'll take one more. There's one in the back.
Lee Edwards, I'm at the Department of Media and Communication here. I was just struck by the fact that there's not much discussion about the actual sources of disinformation or misinformation. So there's a whole industry, part of which is very legitimate. It's the marketing and PR industry that produce material that the media may or may not then pick up. But those practitioners and some of those companies are using the same techniques to perpetuate the misinformation that is also circulating. And it seems to me that if while we're looking at media and we're looking at platforms, there is also the issue of the sources of disinformation that needs to be addressed somehow, and I'd be interested to see what the panel think might be possible there.
Right. Who would like to take one piece of that? Damien, some of it was addressed to you as an academic.
I would be very careful about suggesting that an authority should monitor speech on media. There are a number of things that it can do, for example, audit self-regulatory initiatives. I think we need to be very careful. There's a strong tradition of independent regulatory agencies which are separate from the state. It doesn't work everywhere, but any intervention has to be very careful about not going down the slippery slope of censorship. Really, really important. Fact-checkers are an important part of the solution. They have collaborated in really interesting ways with Facebook. I think the horizon question is whether platforms can be encouraged, stroke obliged, to optimize their algorithm, not for linger or advertising revenue or some other commercial benefit to themselves, but for quality. And I think that Facebook are very interested in rhetoric about that, but I'm very skeptical about them actually doing something which undermines their bottom line and does so it's inevitable that it would, I would say. Experts in the academy, really important that we're careful. I've been to far too many conferences and workshops where, we're very fuzzy about the objectives when we're defending against threats to what we see as the liberal democratic order. This is not about excluding new political actors. We need new political actors. We need renewal. We need new ideas. But it's about the rules of the game, and it's about fundamental rights. So we have to be very careful about the categories of speech that we propose to regulate. And in terms of, you know, understanding the sources of information, that's also a question of transparency. All of the new proposals for electoral laws are about Facebook saying who is funding the advertising and being very transparent about that. But that's a tiny category of what we see. Yeah, it's just the paid advertising. How can we be more transparent about sources of information more generally, and what Honora O'Neill would call the accessibility of the information? Not just we should trust information more, but there should be due trust. We should trust where it's deserved, and we should absolutely mistrust when it's not.
Max, you haven't said anything for a while.
I mean, the question about interventions and what, how do you step into a place where you see a lot of misinformation, either from a malicious actor or coming about organically, and do something, kind of confront and challenge it, I think is one that we're all struggling with, because the research on fact checkers is pretty mixed at best. There's some cases where it will work if you do it in certain ways and if you catch things early, but kind of once a rumor is caught on, fact checking is perceived as adversarial, so people tend to reject it and then be that much more hardened in whatever is the fact check piece of information. I think basically, as far as I can tell, no one has yet answered this question, but there's this one social psychologist who's doing really interesting research kind of related to misinformation and political violence, and her best research is actually on school bullying and is on this question of how does a school, a bunch of kids, 1,000, 10,000 kids, come to have or reject a social norm that bullying is okay, which is a kind of information, right? It's not a fact. It's more of a social norm, but I think kind of getting to a place of understanding that people care about the social norms more than they care about the facts. And what she found was that a overt intervention, like what you're talking about, like having a teacher come in and say, hey, you shouldn't bully, and here's why, was kind of mixed effective. But something that was really effective was taking pre-existing students, so people from within the group that they were trying to change the behavior of, identifying the ones who were the most problematic actors and just literally moving them to the margins of the classroom, and then taking the people who both had, she calls them social cues, but there was just basically an indication that people paid attention to them, and then working with them directly to say, you already have good ideas that we like, and you have people paying attention to you, so we're going to put you in the middle of the class, literally in the center, and here are some things we think you could say to have people trust you and listen to you when you say that bullying is bad. And that actually made a huge difference. And I think that is what is tough for people like us who represent capital I institutions, is that we want the interventions to come from us, but that is actually not that effective, and it has to come from within groups where you want to see behavior changed, and that behavior might include resistance to misinformation.
I don't know, I was at the fact check last, there's this thing called Global Fact Check. It's this global conference which brings together all the fact checkers of the world. It's quite a new thing. I think they had their fifth one this summer. And look, some of the people there are just heroes. There are literally people who are prepared to be arrested for facts and to literally risk their lives for facts, especially in these kind of authoritarian, new wave authoritarian states like Turkey, places in Latin America. And look, these people were just heroes. I mean, because they were taking an incredible stance in societies where actually facts don't matter anymore. They were just saying, no, they do actually, and I'm going to stand here and fight for something. So it was a moral thing. Others did really practical things. So they were fact checkers during cataclysms, during typhoons or earthquakes, and they were just giving accurate information about, like, you know, where to go. They were super popular because that's really practical information. You need facts to survive. Most of them were in despair when you talked to them a little bit. So there was a great guy from Italy going, oh, look, we managed to catch Salvini out on a lie. And I was like, what's happened since then? He's like, he's become the most powerful man in the country. So for all their fact-checking, it was just like such a rise of politicians who don't give a flying monkeys about facts. Salvini doesn't care when he's caught. He just moves on. You know. So they were kind of in despair. And I think that there's a bigger challenge of how do we generate conversations where facts matter again. And there's many ways of thinking about how we do that. But I think that's what's maybe disappeared. How do we create a discourse where you can catch somebody out on lying and they really care about that? I don't have a single answer for that. There might be philosophical reasons behind it, historical ones, technological ones with the way the algorithms work, or just questions of accountability, that it doesn't matter if you're caught being corrupt. You know, it doesn't matter in a lot of countries. It doesn't matter in Ukraine. So maybe accountability has to change. I was kind of very, very intrigued by my experience with the fact checkers. There was something almost religious about what they were doing. They were trying to raise facts up again and bless them with the incense of transparency and the Holy Spirit of impartiality. And they already had heretics. There was the wrong sort of fact checker who did the wrong sort of fact checks. And then there were the Jesuits, and there were splits happening. It was in Rome and in St. Stephen's, and it felt very kind of like, you know, a bit like a religious movement. But I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we have to somehow elevate facts again so they feel a little bit sacred. When I told the fact checkers this, because, you know, obviously I confronted them with this, they were like, well, factually, that's not quite accurate, because we don't have an eschatology. I was like, well, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I heard recently just an anecdote that The Guardian they used to say, facts are sacred, opinion is free. Now they say, opinion is free, facts are expensive.
Right.
That's very good.
I'll take randomly one more question, because we're now at the very end. Is there one more person who wants to speak? Let's go right here, and then I'll let people say anything they want to wrap up.
I'm a philosophy student, so currently I have a philosophy question. To what extent is like the disinformation that exists in all these countries classifiable, and then potentially under some jurisdictions' ideologies prohibitable under like hate speech? I don't know, like based on your ideology, you may think that like a lot of far-right stuff can be classified as hate speech, and hate speech is a type of speech that can be regulated. So that's the question.
You have to have laws on hate speech that,
yeah.
And some countries have them and some don't, and some are very specific and some aren't. But anyway, you want to answer that?
Yeah, I think
why don't you all answer either that or anything else you've heard? Go on, Max. Yes.
I think that we are coming to have a very different understanding that we used to have about speech that can cause real-world harm. And I think that for a long time we've kind of cordoned it off to, you know, we are going to disallow things that cross certain bars that we're going to make very high because we want to have free and open discourse, which is great, and then we're going to allow other things. Or we might have social sanctions, but, you know, generally we're going to allow them in, like, a legal sense. And I think it's becoming, maybe it was always true that there was a category of speech in the blurry middle that was socially harmful but that we considered permissible, or maybe that's now becoming true because information travels in a way that is very different than it used to on social media, in the sense that it is totally user and demand driven rather than driven by institutions like us. But I think a lot about a study that came out of the University of Warwick a few months ago that looked at Facebook usage in Germany, and it found that over, I think, a 3-year span, when they were having their really big wave of anti-refugee attacks, they looked at thousands of towns across the country over 3 years and found that in any town, not only did Facebook usage, controlling for all other factors, correlate with attacks on refugees, but where Facebook usage became one standard deviation above the national average. And again, this is controlling for things like internet access, popularity of the AFD, pre-existing politics, pre-existing presence of crime. If Facebook usage was one standard deviation above the mean, attacks on refugees rose by 50%. And nobody really knows why this is, but the general theory is that there's a lot of speech on Facebook, much as there is in society, that is legal, that is legally permissible. Things like, you know, an AFD slogan, or, you know, a campaign to draw attention to a legitimate, actual refugee crime, but maybe in a way that plays it up more than is, you know, quite true, that changes people's behavior in a way that leads to actual violence. And I think that in the West, and generally in developed countries, we've been able to take kind of a, like, academic, isn't this interesting view to all of this. But when I have done reporting in places like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, you see that it's actually pretty significant. And you see that actually the stakes of having free and open discourse, even to ideas that we say we don't like, can be hundreds or thousands of tens of thousands of lives. And I don't have an answer for where is the line, at what point does speech become dangerous, what do we do when it is, But I think that we are just getting to a point of confronting that that speech exists in places where we have not thought about cordoning it off before.
It's wonderful to hear an American say this, because I remember when we dared to even raise this issue in America at the at the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was like, I actually raised it with David Remnick, and he was like, I'm a free speech fundamentalist, you can't even touch this stuff. And I'm like, really? Something's changing? And then Tim Wu wrote his wonderful book, and I think it's amazing how far America has come. I think in Europe we've always had ideas that that's actually possible. But very practically on that one, so two things. Friends of mine did an analysis for Facebook about the, or was it Google, one of these two nefarious companies, about terrorist content on their platform. I think it was actually Google. And they found, they categorized it into 9 forms of speech. And there's only 2 out of those 9 was actually legal, which is literally like, go kill the Jews, or like, you know, stuff like that. Beyond that, you know, very, very, very hard, even within kind of, you know, the British structure, maybe within the German structure would be easier. So the other day, we were thinking a lot about what to do about these troll factories, which go around attacking people and making their life hell, and, you know, but which always claim, like, well, free speech. We're just using free speech. Why can't we troll this person? And so I was sitting around with some legal scholars in D.C., and they were like, we have to flip this question around. Stop making this a free speech issue. Make this a human rights issue. This is an attack on the human rights of the victim. Yeah? Free speech, forget about it. Speech can be used as censorship. Yeah? It is not letting these people speak their, you know, get their...
And it's not only governments that censor.
Yeah, exactly. Well, these organizations usually use to link to governments at some level, actually. But... turn it into a human rights issue. Are the human rights of the victim being attacked? Then we can actually have a basis in existing law to act against them. When you're into those free speech categories, golly, it gets so hard for legal people. So maybe we should just return to human rights, but for a 21st century paradigm.
Do either of you want to add anything to anything that's been said?
Well, I think it's a very good question. There is law, there's a lot of law on hate speech and incitement. In France and Germany, there are standards, for example, on Holocaust denial. There are European-wide standards. There's a new directive that came up, was agreed last week, which extended those anti-discrimination standards onto platforms like Facebook, video-sharing platforms. North America, well, the US in particular's First Amendment tradition is much more fundamentalist about these things. So there is Tim Garton Ash's recent book is very good on this, because what we have is in these global media is a need for new global standards. The UN Convention on Racial Discrimination has some, but they're kind of fluffy and they're not implemented anyway. So I think the next chapter in all of this is really going to be about Europe, where there's a lot more activity because we have different kinds of standards and there's a lot of political will to deal particularly with terrorism and hate speech. But then it's a bit like California in the US. Europe will define standards which could then become global in effect. So we're having a debate about what is okay to say where. A lot of that is about what platforms moderate themselves. It's messy, it's difficult, but it's really important we keep an eye on it and that we ensure that civil society voices are heard and we get some sort of a balance between liberty on the one hand and accountability on the other.
Oliver, you have the last word.
I just want to remind everyone of the wise words of Arthur Weasley, really. You know, don't trust anything if you can't see where it keeps its brain. It applies to everything, I think. Genuine. If it can think for itself. I mean, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to the audience.